Welcome to Relevant Parties by Carhartt Work in Progress. I'm Chelle Ravens, and in this series, I'm going behind the scenes at some of the world's best independent record labels to meet the visionaries and the obsessives who've made musical history. In each episode, we sit down with one of these label founders to find out what makes them tick. We hear the tall tales and big ideas behind some of the most influential records and scenes of the past 30 years, and maybe try to work out just what possessed them to take on one of the most challenging jobs in the music industry. My guest on this episode of Relevant Parties is Samuel Valenti IV, whose rather grand-sounding moniker doesn't really have any bearing on his overall demeanour. Samuel is the head of Ghostly International, founded in Ann Arbor, Michigan in 1999. And Ghostly is named kind of in jest. I guess at the time he was poking fun at the idea of being some kind of big international brand with a shiny headquarters and a snazzy logo. But as it turns out, 20-odd years into the label's history, Ghostly kind of is a big international brand with a shiny headquarters and a snazzy logo. Or at least as much as that can be possible for an independent label still releasing strange and wonderful electronic music from the fringes. Samuel is originally from the suburbs of Detroit, and Detroit is really crucial to the story of Ghostly, the industrial history and also the legacy of techno and Midwestern dance music. It's a label centred around a few key Detroit figures, certainly from the beginning, Matthew Deer, Tad Mullenix and Todd Osborne. And over the years, this core nucleus has remained intact, even as the label has expanded in all kinds of directions musically. There's Mary Lattimore's harp music, Dabry's freaky hip-hop instrumentals, epic electronic vistas by Telephone Tel Aviv and Steve Housechild, and of course the entire discography of Spectral Sound, the dance floor-oriented counterpart to Ghostly. But what's really unique about Ghostly in the world of indie record labels is that it's so much more than a record label. On top of the music they put out, there's this whole universe of things, beautiful art prints, all kinds of objects for your wardrobe and for your life. There's mugs, t-shirts, there's umbrellas, once there was coffee, there's a micro sampler, I've seen a xylophone. There are collaborations with brands like Eastpak and Vans. They even made a solid marble record crate. And rather unlike a lot of indie record label bosses throughout history, Samuel is a savvy businessman. He's an early adopter kind of guy. And throughout the existence of Ghostly, which exactly corresponds with the shift from physical into digital media, he has spent a lot of time testing ideas for how to make a label work in the 21st century. And he's doing pretty well at it. So I spoke to him on the phone from his home in New York, and we talked about the early days of Ghostly in the record stores of Ann Arbor, about navigating the slippery economics of the music industry, about death and the loss of an important mentor, and about the indignity of being labelled goop for the Pitchfork set. So here we go, Relevant Parties meets Ghostly International. It's breakfast time in New York. Where are you now? Maybe you could paint a picture.
Sure. I am home at my apartment in Upper East Side, New York, which is actually a really sort of poignant place to be at this moment. So yeah, I think it's, you know, the sun is shining. So there is a sense that the world is trying to become anew. But yeah, it's a strange, solemn moment for sure.
Yeah, definitely the fact that it's so sunny has been really strange here. But even just sitting outside, is you feel like you're not really supposed to. You're not really supposed to be enjoying yourself in any way, obviously, because all of this stuff is going on. So
exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so Ghostly is very much not just a record label. No record label is just a record label, I guess, but Ghostly does a lot of things. You create a lot of other things. There are all kinds of items that you can get that have a Ghostly badge on them. I've found some t-shirts and tote bags. There are like art prints, very beautiful art prints. I found a xylophone in the store. I'm not sure if you still sell that. But a few years ago, you made probably the strangest piece of label merchandise I've ever seen, which was a solid marble record crate. carved to look like it's kind of crumbling to pieces, like a sort of ancient Greek temple ruin that you can also put vinyl in. I mean, I don't even want to think about the shipping costs for buying that, but tell me, why would you make such a thing?
It's a great question. I think as you talk to a lot of record label people, everyone has their sort of motivations, right? I mean, a lot of great labels start because it's an artist who can't find a place to put out their music, or the industry has sort of shunned them. You find people who have a friend whose music needs to be heard, which I kind of feel like I fall in that category. But I also like making things or being involved in the making of things. And I think the physical aspect of music culture to me has always been really compelling. Starting as a DJ in the 90s with buying vinyl, and of course the story of Ghostly also kind of maps over the history of the digitization of music to some degree. When I started, it was, you know, I was file sharing using Napster and LimeWire and stuff in my dorm room. But still, to me, it was like, oh, well, I think there's still a need for like objects. So I think to get back to the question, I think the idea of all the stuff we do is kind of, it's a timestamp, it's a collaboration. So it's a memory of working with somebody. My former colleague, Brian Fichtner, was in touch with this design studio called Snarkitecture, who is Daniel Arsham and Alex Mustonen, who make really crazy objects, usually that have that sort of eroding reliquary type feeling. And so we talked about what we should do. And, you know, obviously vinyl is sort of the atomic element. It's the first thing Ghostly ever made. It's the thing, hopefully the last thing Ghostly ever makes. And it's like, well, I don't know if we thought too deep about it, but I think what I think of it as is it's both a love letter and sort of like a death knell for the vinyl era, right? So it's this medium that kind of comes and goes out of popularity. It's heavy, it's expensive, it's petroleum, it's kind of egotistical, but it's also like sort of elemental. And so I think the crate, to me, we only made three of them. We actually never put them up for sale, but they were kind of meant as a story around records. Like, is it like a weight pulling us down? Is it a time-honored, you know, battered badge of respect for this medium? Like, sort of more of a question mark. But yeah, I think Ghostly as a record label is meant to be a platform for ideas and collaborations and artists.
Okay, let's get a bit biographical here. So Samuel Valenti IV immediately makes me think there is a third, second, and first. So that's kind of interesting to me. Certainly in Europe, in the UK, it's quite unusual to have to meet somebody who is a third or a fourth. So I guess my question is, who are the Valentis? What is your grand lineage?
It's funny. I feel like my European and international friends think it means more than it does.
Yeah.
I think because numbers have sort of like a stateliness to them.
Oh, very much so. It seems grand to me.
Yeah. So I think to me, it's almost like I tease that it's just unimaginative parents. I guess I was supposed to be like Christopher John or some sort of 70s-ish name. And then I was born and I looked like my dad. And then they were like, oh, you should be Sam. it wasn't that like big of a story. My dad's Sam III, who grew up in Detroit. His dad was the second. So, I mean, yeah, so it's not, there's no story beyond just lookalikes. yeah, I mean, my parents are from Met in Michigan. I don't have any sort of a musical or artistic legacy, really. Music fandom ran in the house. I still have my dad's records. He was a big Motown guy. He talks about like dropping the needle on the Temptations in college. And they would go to shows in Detroit at the Fox Theater and see like Little Stevie Wonder. And I just think Michigan is just the music city. Every like 10, 20 years, it has a big innovation of the last, you know, whether it's like obviously Motown or, you know, MC5, Stooges era. Obviously, Detroit techno is a big one for me. Even like some of the hip hop, like Dilla and other things. Like, it's just a very self-styled city. Obviously, it's exported that to the world. But I also think it's the musical culture of Michigan that kind of is like the DNA of Ghostly is radio culture, like DJs playing all different kinds of sounds, mixing them into one thing and making it seem cohesive. And obviously, Kraftwerk, we just lost Florian. But Kraftwerk's music is like adhered to Detroit in a really powerful way. The DJ culture of Detroit took from Italo Disco and Kraftwerk and P-Funk and kind of like stewed it into its own thing. So there's like a weird Eurocentric angle that Ghost, that Detroit understood, and I think used, grafted itself onto. And I think that to me as a kid growing up, buying records felt very liberating because I was more of a hip hop fan. And then realizing that, oh, you can listen to Kraftwerk. And then the hip hop records are like sample jazz. And then, you know, a Warp Records was taking drum and bass, which was sort of a deviation of hip hop, and pushing it into this outer limit. So I felt like Detroit has aided all of that development. And Ghostly is just sort of a disciple of that thinking.
So whereabouts did you grow up? Not quite in the center, somewhere else? Suburbs?
I grew up in the burbs. Got into DJing in high school. I was really more into the hip-hop thing, and so scratching and all that stuff. And started DJing dances and house parties and things. Had my little speakers that I would cart around. And
and you were DJ Space Ghost, right?
I was DJ Space Ghost.
So the ghost thing is like, it was already in there right from the beginning.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it was just I thought it was fun to draw, and you could do the little ghostly logo. I would like do the fake graffiti type tags, and that just felt, it just felt like a cool, there was no real meaning. It just felt right. And then I kept seeing, I was like, oh yeah, I want to do a label, because labels to me seem like, oh, I'm not going to make music. I just kind of knew that wasn't my talent, but a label could be like a Def Jam sleeve. It's like a image and a graphic and a sound. Identity, like a little bit of world building. And Detroit labels were a really good template, right? So Planet E, Transmet, Ersatz Audio, Interdimensional Transmissions, they all had, all the Detroit artists had their own imprint. It was almost like a car manufacturing stamp. Like Transmet had a big logo, and that was Derek May's church, and Planet E had this Carl Craig's. And because all the artists had their own labels, it seemed very accessible. You could make your record, put it in your trunk. You could go to Record Time, sell some copies to the store, go back next week, pick up your cash, drop some more off. So it felt, it was very like accessible. And then you, and then everybody would come through that store. So every DJ in the city, Mike Huckabee, who we just lost as well, was sort of one of the gatekeepers of the sound. Right. And he would go, that record's crap. You want this Maurizio record. You want this. Go to the listening station. And you were sort of like, it was almost like the military. Like you were hardened into taste in a good way.
I heard that he would like have records ready for whichever DJ came in, to the extent where he was kind of deciding what the whole city was playing. Amazing.
Exactly. And not just techno, but house DJs, hip hop DJs. He'd have a little paper bag with a name on it and be like, boom. And DJ Godfather worked there. Mike Servito worked there. Yeah. Plas Laco. And so you had this like neural network of like pre-internet taste engine, which is super helpful. And that's why I'm so devoted to record stores, because I think I've learned more from record stores than I have from anything else. Just being around people who care. I'm very loyal to that construct, even though I know it will change and has changed.
So tell me about a DJ called House Shoes, and how House Shoes kind of brought you into the world of clubs.
You've done your research. Yeah, so House Shoes is currently based in LA, but a Detroit DJ, one of the best hip hop DJs I've ever seen. Worked alongside DJ Dez, was one of the people responsible for helping put Dilla's work into the world, and helping JD when he was called then, giving him a platform and helping build that. So House Shoes would DJ at Friday nights at St. Andrew's Hall, which is there's a really funny Spin article from the 90s. Maybe you've seen, or I'll forward to you. It was like the roughest bouncers in America. There's a photo of all of them. It's like the toughest roughnecks. But so St. Andrew's Hall had three floors. The upstairs room ended up being kind of like a chill out room often. The main room was a hip hop night every Friday. And he was the Mike Huckabee of a store called Street Corner Music in Southfield, which has since moved. But he was the hip hop guy, and he'd get all the records. He would set me up, you know, hey, get this, get, check that out, save stuff for me. I actually still have my first JD Slum Village tape that he sold me in 95. It was like a Xeroxed J Dilla homemade tape. That's probably my most prized musical possession. Yeah, he was like, I think he knew I could drive him to work, basically. I don't know how this happened, but he's like, come down. If you want to go to see me hang out, come down with me when I load into the club. Help me bring my records in, and you don't have to get carded. So I was able to like go listen to music. I would just sit and listen. I can't remember even trying to drink, because I knew I wouldn't happen. I just would sit and listen and play for a few hours. And every Friday, he's sort of setting the scene, playing these sounds that he got that week. And then I would come in Monday, oh, what was that? And then I would go to Record Time also. So you're starting to get this honing effect of taste that was really fun. So yeah, House Shoes, I consider my first DJ mentor, musical mentor.
Was he playing mainly music from Detroit, mainly hip hop from Detroit, local stuff? Or
No, he was, I mean, I think there wasn't actually that much to go around, really.
Okay, yeah.
I think it was playing, and I think that era to me too, of like maybe 92 to 96, hip hop had a really great moment. Obviously the Biggies and the Wu-Tangs and Nas's, but you had major label values as far as production value attached to like a really amazing producer culture. And then so there was money being spent on music that was really vibrant at the right time. Because I think post Dr. Dre, every major thought rap was going to be their big breadwinner. So a lot of really good records were made expensively that maybe wouldn't have been made. So I was very firmly a hip hop kid. I didn't really understand electronic music until I started going to raves, which were adjacent, you know. Detroit rave culture kind of came and went a couple times. And then late 90s, there was a new wave. So like Detroit rave was always like abandoned auto factory, you know, suburban promoter, books, five DJs, does flyers, but just puts a number, a map point, you called for it, go to this place. You would the next day or two, you'd blow black crap out of your nose because you would be inhaling all that whatever was on the walls. And
that's a real rave. Deaf.
Yeah, that was great. And it was, you know, and I think that the physicality of dance music and actually hearing it live and seeing how fascinating it was. It wasn't even about drugs. It was about just like, oh, OK, this is what this music is. It wasn't the cheesy CD they had at the store. It was a thing and an experience, and it liberated my mind and made me excited about so much more.
Mm. And when you say factories, did you go to the Packard plant?
Yeah, Packard was the best one
right.
that I remembered. Yeah.
For those who will never go, I guess, was it already, like a closed down abandoned factory in that at that time? It was just like ruins? Because it's kind of ruins now,
it was
now,
probably
right?
20 years gone,
yeah, okay.
maybe. Where the raves were held was completely, you know, desolate. You know, then I think the cops started cracking down more towards the late 90s and it sort of died back down. Mm-hmm. But getting a taste of it and then, again, the same record store, straying into a different section and taking more risks. It felt like a complete education, a complete circle where all of that music was in play.
Mm.
You know, even, and this is before the label existed. This was just like me, my basement every weekend listening to records and making mixtapes. And that's my purest state is like, you know, just listening, enjoying records and the happiness of diving into a new discovery.
So you went to college in Ann Arbor. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And studied art history.
Yeah.
What was your kind of plan for when you went to Ann Arbor? What did you think you were going to do with your life at that point?
I found my like college letter that I, you know, like you would write a one pager to three pager to say like, I'm going to do this or whatever. And I forgot I did it, but I actually said I wanted to start a label.
Wow.
Which was funny to me because I thought it was more sort of ambling at the time. I thought I was just kind of like figuring it out, but I guess I had an idea for it. And I definitely had the name. I had no artists on the label. You know, I didn't know any people who made music really. So I didn't think of it as like a job. I was like, oh, I think you can make a record and sell it and figure it out. I didn't think anything about really the long term, but I was excited about the aesthetic and the like sound that I was excited about, which is more house and techno at the time. And I met a couple of key people. I met, Dave Shaman, who was Disco D, this is DJ name, who was kind of like the next Sherpa up the mountain. He had already put out a record and self-released one and worked with Bad Boy Bill out of Chicago on one, and already was DJing at clubs. And he was underage too, so he had to sneak into his own gigs. And then I also met Matthew Deer at a house party. He was playing in the basement. I think they let him play there just because he asked, and he had a synthesizer and a drum machine. He was playing a live set of like techno. And I was like, oh, this is cool. And I asked, I was like, oh, can I get your number? We should talk about music. I don't know what I said. And ended up having lunch the next week. And then for the next year, just kind of became friends with him. And we'd go through material and be like, oh, this is a good one. This is a good one. And started talking about the label that I wanted to do and sort of planning to put a record out. So him and Dave were the first record on Ghostly.
Mm. What was Matthew like at the time?
I think he was, I mean, Matt has always had confidence. Maybe that was appealing. I think he always had like a sense of, he knew he was good at what he was going to do. Mm-hmm. And he was also very excited and very focused. Like I had my turntables in my dorm room and he hadn't started DJing yet, but he would just come over and he could just practice and play. Any chance he had to DJ, he would take it. He would throw raves in the basement of the pizza shop he worked at. and like, I say raves with a lowercase R. Yeah, he was just kind of like having fun and making stuff. And yeah, we just became friends and we were like, Dave, help us finish this record. And we went over to his house with Matthew's floppy disks from his MPC, and Dave helped sequence out Put Your Hands Up for Detroit, which is our first A-side. You know, got it done, made it, had a record, sold them out of my trunk to the stores. Detroit DJs were playing it, so it felt like validating. It wasn't a business, but it was a thing. It existed.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, or what the impact of that record was, because given that it had this second life via the Fede LeGrand track, it's like, yeah, it feels almost like a kind of cult item in a sense. But I don't know, what was the kind of impact at the time? Did it seem like it was a good kind of entry for Ghostly into the world?
Well, I think it became, in sort of its legacy, it became more than it was. And also, I love it as a talisman because it's Dave and Matt, and then the art on the back is Michael Siegel, who is the first artist, visual artist I work with. So it's kind of this like complete, I wanted the cover to look like New Order Substance, because that was always my favorite cover. This is the Bodoni font. It was perfect, like pristine. The back is this cartoon. The record is these two characters. And so, yeah, I like it as a like atomic element DNA point, but it's not really like, we don't keep it in stock. We don't even have it available for digital sales. I like it as like an artifact.
In a way, I guess it's definitely an artifact of that exact time period as well, because it has a kind of almost like a French touch kind of 90s disco thing.
We were trying
to
do French touch. Yeah. Filtered disco.
Great.
So it's kind of crap, but it's like sweet. It's like a punk 7-inch that's like trying to just make something that that you're proud of. You
know? But maybe just around the corners, a kind of different strand of techno was coming up that you got a little bit more interested in, and the kind of minimal stuff, and which is it's a lot less flamboyant, obviously.
It's a good word.
Yeah. So that track obviously had a second life. Yeah, it was actually number one in the UK, the Fede LeGrand version. So to me, I was like, oh, there's an original to that track that I remember from back then.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know. Yeah. And we don't really like wave it around just because it's kind of its own fun little narrative. It got sampled. It was kind of a back and forth as to like who was it and whose is it, and we figured it out, you know. But it also speaks to the sort of narrative of how dance music works, right?
Like, totally.
That I always loved, like, there's a DJ, Carlos Souffrant from Michigan, that is in the Bay now. He always talked about records being kind of like a call and response to each other. Records are conversation amongst themselves, especially in Detroit techno, where you had like Richie Houghton and Derek, and they would kind of go back and forth. So that record becoming another record is a perfect, I love how you don't know what's going to happen. Once you release a record to the wind, it becomes its own story. How that little kernel of Matthew's voice that we left at the end of a track as an acapella became fodder, like a sort of cannon fodder, like a raw strand to use for another whole era of like electro house and club culture, using Detroit as this sort of like buzzword that obviously carries volumes. And the language between Detroit and the UK too is always is a very storied one too. And Detroit techno maybe wouldn't be what it is without having been amplified by UK rave, from what I understand. That's my understanding of the history. And
I'd like to know a lot more about Disco D though. Tell me a little bit about David.
David was like the classic high energy, sort of hyper, like sometimes even like annoying, but like he would come up and kind of like slap you in the head and like, but it was always like loving, but he was just like too much energy, like ADD kid. And I think he was like kind of a band nerd and kind of like a quasi pro rollerblader and all this stuff before I knew him, but he was always like the overachiever. And yeah, just like a really great human, very spiritual and connected and thoughtful. And we lost Dave 2008. Dave took his life. I mean, he had some really heavy issues with bipolar, and you know, I think just as a lot of people do, succumb to the illness. I miss him a lot, especially these days, because I know how successful Dave would be, and how much it'd be fun to connect with him and see what he's doing. And I think of Matthew as the sort of founding artist. I think of Dave as sort of a spiritual co-founder, as a inspiration. You know, that friend that everyone has that's sort of like high octane, but pushes you to be better, you know.
I like the idea of him being the second Sherpa of the mountain.
Yeah, for sure.
So in that period, I guess a lot's going on in terms of you trying to, well, not trying to, quite quickly, I think, establishing what Ghostly is going to be. So you launch Spectral Sound pretty soon afterwards as well, as I guess a dance music label, but it's not really a sub-label, is it? It's more of a sister, I guess. Or tell me, what was the purpose of Spectral, and how does it kind of continue to, well, it continues to exist, of course. So tell me about that kind of auxiliary stream of music you've got coming out in Spectral.
So Spectral is the sister label. I think of it as the yin yang of Ghostly. It's kind of, you know, it's not a junior, it's a right. You know, the name obviously means like dark ghost specter. The logo has like a little like Lisa Left Eye Lopez hash mark under the eye, which I'd seen cool at the time. It was just like the Jekyll Hyde of Ghostly. And it's the purpose is mostly around dance music, electro, house, techno, and tributaries from there. But I think coming from the Midwestern dance music tradition, I always felt like you needed like a grounding cable. So I like the idea of having this sort of Ghostly being this, you know, free range garden that's allowed to do whatever it needs to do to get to evolve. And then Spectral being kind of this through line of dance music, and they blur, they kind of like train tracks, they sort of intersect. There's artists kind of leave one, leave, start at the other. But it's 150 releases now, and less prolific than Ghostly, which is, I think, is around 350, but it has the, it's sort of on a need to know basis. Whenever we find music we love, it just happens. And then the origin of that is the next Sherpas are Todd Osborne and Tad Mullenix, who records as Dabry and JTC and Charles Monnier and a bunch of other cool aliases, and has his own label Bopside. So Todd Osborne, who has recorded for the label as well as Reflex, as well as Running Back and a lot of awesome labels, he had a record store called Dubplate Pressure that I was going to in Ann Arbor. And Todd's sort of a character. He's like, you have to sort of make him like you a little bit. You have to sort of earn your trust with him.
Classic record shop dude.
Yeah. But he's like, it's not because he's trying to sort of, he's not guarding anything. He just doesn't want to deal with your nonsense. If you're going to come in and blab all day and waste his time, he just can't deal, because he's just got so much on his mind. He just has his own agenda in a good way. Another force multiplier person that kind of pushes your taste. And eventually Tad Mullenix was working for him at the store, and Tad was DJing and had been making music and been in bands his whole life, and kind of was like the skater kid with a shaved head who played in like death metal or like noise bands and made techno and house. He was just like kind of this brainiac genius. Hmm. And I think I came into the store one day and Tad was working, and Todd had had the first Ghostly record that Tad had seen. And, Todd's like, hey, Tad should give you some music. He has his own stuff. And I was like, oh yeah, that'd be great. You know, and Tad went to his car and brought a cassette tape. That was, again, the pre-CDR era. And I took it home, and he's like, yeah, it's all sorts of stuff on it, but check out the first stuff. It's like the techno stuff. And I was like, kept listening to it, like auto reverse back and forth, and being like, holy shit, this is, everything on here is good. And there's like IDM, hip hop beats, house, techno, like sort of EBM industrial, like, how could this be one person? So eventually we started talking, and I was like, we got to put out a lot of this. Like, and then Tad sort of structured all the aliases based on the sounds. I think some of them he already had, some of them he made up. And we were like, okay. So now it's like, okay, Ghostly now has just changed entirely, where Ghostly has to be freeform. And Spectral, at the time, Matthew was just making a focus on dance music. And both of them need their own lanes. So in some ways, you know, they're the image that the label was founded on, is like diversity of sound and experimentation. So Tad Mullenix is, we sort of reset the clock. GI1 is Tad Mullenix's debut. Spectral 1 is Matthew Deer's second record, but GHS001 is the last of the Hands Up for Detroit, sort of is walled off, and then Ghostly starts with those two artists around 2000-2001.
Right, this is why I got a little bit lost in the discogs for a while, where there were several things that were number one. I was like, someone's someone's papered over the history here somehow.
Yeah.
This record shop, I'm a little bit intrigued by a record store called Dubplate Pressure, because to me that sounds quite UK. I don't know if that's like the focus of that store, but I definitely get the sense that Todd and Tad were interested in kind of jungle IDM stuff that was coming from the UK, and maybe to an extent Detroit more broadly was into that, but I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, there's always been a strain of drum and bass fandom. To me, it was the next logical music from hip hop because it had a lot of the more like jump up DJ hype type things had the Redman vocal samples, and like those artists would remix like Erykah Badu or Aaliyah. So if you got the UK 12, it had the drum and bass remix on it. So to me, it was like a safe first step into electronic music where I was like, oh, this is kind of like hip hop adjacent. And then Todd and Tad were making their own records. They did these Raga records that were really great under Sound Murderer, which is Todd, and SK1, which is Tad. So they had already released a record too. But yeah, they were buying UK Jungle Records and Warp Records, as well as Detroit Techno. And so Todd's store was, yeah, very much that feeder. And I remember that being the first electronic music, I was just like, wow, this is awesome. It's so futuristic, but sort of like metalheads, 96, 7. Obviously, I loved like Fotech and Source Direct, and they were more into, I think, Ram and a lot of those. I like sort of the more melodic, like V records sound, and yeah, it just seemed exciting. You also could mix it halftime, you know, with like 80 BPM hip hop to 160 BPM drum and bass, so you could, the Legos fit together, which to me seemed exciting. So I started buying those records, and Todd was sort of like that next wave of discovery, and then Tad being a wealth of musical knowledge and his taste coming in to Ghostly. Yeah, that's the next crew. I mean, and Tad is still, I work with him every year on something. Same with Matthew and same with Todd, you know.
And were they a crew in a kind of real sense? Did you guys hang out locally and go to shows together and stuff, or was it a little bit more business?
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like Ghostly helped put a frame around a lot of disparate artists that didn't really, there was no really affiliation. Like Todd and Tad were friends, Matt and I were friends, there was record store people like Dykehouse, and there wasn't like a focused scene. So I think the early days of Ghostly was like sort of scene making. So Ann Arbor, because it's a college town, it like washes away. It's like the sandcastle that like goes away every 4 years, which is great because it allows for new things, but it also like it doesn't have a permanence.
Yeah.
So there was a night called Solar, which Dave Disco DJ'd at, and they would bring like Kenny Larkin and Sean Deason and Carl Craig to Ann Arbor. So that was like the first parties that I really liked. And then Ghostly started doing events around 2000, 2001 at a club called Necto. It was a Nectarine, actually, where Jeff Mills was the wizard and DJ'd at the Nectarine in the 80s. That was his, where he got his start. So again, there's no connection anymore, but there's all these sort of shrines to the past. And Brendan Gillen, who runs Interdimensional Transmissions and is Ectomorph, a part of Ectomorph, was sort of another mentor. He had the radio show on WCBN, and Brendan had already had success releasing records on his own label. He had put out IF's Space Invaders Are Smoking Grass in America, which is a hugely inspirational record for us as a crew. It was like this perfect pop electro combustion engine, and he was really helpful and showing me the way. I just go to his house and we just talk for hours about music and revel in that. And there wasn't really a scene. So I think Ghostly was able to put these DJs on in rotation. We started a night called Touch with our friend John Ozias at Necto. And the big room was a big DJ. Pretty much all the best Detroit DJs came through. And then we had the glass room, which was the Ghostly room. And it was just a little side room with all our friends. And it was goofy. And I would play. Matt would play, Tab would play, Todd would play, and it was just like that was a testing ground. So every week they could bring their new stuff, sort of road test the music live. So like oh, that track you played at midnight, what was that? We should put that out. Mm-hmm. And then again, the flywheel of creation, dissemination, distribution, it all was connected. And then I started to have more of a crew. My friend Lissa was the first employee at Ghostly. It was at my apartment, so she would like. Literally, she had a key, so she would just like come in and I'd be getting up and like we start working. And I don't really know what we thought we were doing. We just would try to figure out, okay, we need to get these jackets printed and let's send 30 copies to New York to Watts Distribution and let's get that remix finished. So eventually, more people started joining the family.
Did you have any advice on how to actually run a label? Anything about the business side?
It was all kind of like just learn from, you know, Dave and Brendan Gillen, and it was kind of slapdash. And then, and I would take whatever I learned from school, marketing class, and try to apply it. And like art history to me wasn't like, I didn't think I was going to work at a gallery or an auction house. I just liked art history is about scenes and groups of artists making a dent eventually becoming too successful and then being unseated by the next crew of artists who hated everything that the other one stood for. So I saw it as like music. It's like the secular. And then 20 years later, there's a new wave of those artists. And it's the same story. So I art history to me was just like a fertile proving ground. It also allowed my visual interests to kind of dovetail with the music. So the Ghostly Five is Disco Nouveau, which was a compilation of new artists doing electro and Italo and sort of 80s style dance music, which was kind of one of our first breakout moments. And really, we got, you know, Simon Reynolds wrote about it in Uncut, and Q wrote about it, and Sleaze Nation, which was the coolest magazine to me at the time, covered our Detroit release party with DMX Crew. And I was like, so I think that was like the Ghostly breakout of like, okay, this is crazy package with a Swedish designer doing the art with all these cool artists like Adult and Ectomorph and IF doing cool songs that are underground, but also very catchy. And like, this is right. This dovetails with Electro Clash unintentionally. Like, cause I remember seeing an ad for Electro Clash in Paper Magazine and being like, this looks cool. And I was like literally putting in the pressing for Disco Nouveau. So I just got lucky with the zeitgeist and that sort of started a whole nother wave of story, but we kind of screwed up, and we screwed up or we did it right, because we kind of shunned that sound right after that. So everyone's like, oh cool, there's this new electro label, but I think I knew how savage the press was about like trend. I knew that trends were like a surefire way to die, because I watched like Gigolo and I watched all these labels that I love kind of, and even Moax was one of my first favorite labels ever, because it was like art and music. And watch how savage Lavelle got, and being like, oh shit, if we don't change our sound, we're going to get stuck. And then we're going to be a fossil. So we kind of actively like stopped doing electro right after that, which kind of, I think, flummoxed our fans, but it also kind of allowed us not to go too far down one lane. So I don't know if it was a good idea or a bad idea, but that was the thinking.
Tell me a little bit about Matthew Dear's first album. Because mm-hmm. when we spoke before briefly about some key records, you labeled this one as getting our shit together. but that's it. But this is 2003. So there's a good 3 years of not entirely getting your shit together. But tell me why that record marks a kind of a milestone in some sense for you.
I've always been an album person, even, it's sort of a contradiction, because I love the single as this sort of mile marker. But albums are the ones that I think, for me, have always been the like statement piece. Plus, it's also a chance to do a sleeve and like tell a big story and do a press release. And I think I knew press responded better to an album. It didn't get stuck in the singles section. It'd be the first big picture. So I was always like, how are we going to make a good album? You know, and I think the first album we did that was good was Dabry's album, Tad Mullenix's record, which is really, I think, still very good. 1-3, which is sort of part of his trilogy. And that got some love.
And Dabry is Tad, we should clarify.
Dabry's Tad. Yeah,
it's Dabry's Tad Mullenix.
Tad being hip-hop. That was where we first got our thing. So Tad was sort of the first out of the gate with an album. 2003, I remember we toured. It was Tad, Matt, and myself. And Tad was the headliner as Dabry. We did Scotland. We did Glasgow. We did London at Plastic People.
Oh, great.
Yeah, like Tad was kind of an underground dude at the time. And people were really starting to like recognize Ghostly as like an actual thing. So I remember doing our first European tour, and I planned them, and I probably was a terrible TM. I still am guilty, feel bad about that, but we got there and we played and did Berlin and met Perlon people and got into the minimal sound that was happening.
Right.
So yeah, it was just this perfect moment of, we were the next new thing in the underground conversation between the US and Europe. And I always felt like America needed another boomerang back. At the time, I didn't think there was a lot of stuff besides the classic crew that was already doing it. There wasn't a lot of new stuff that I thought was challenging the conversations. And it felt good to be part of a new wave of artists.
Let's talk a little bit more about Tad, and I guess a couple of years. So about 3 years after Matthew's debut album.
I can talk about Matthew's. I glossed over that. Sorry.
Well, we did a little bit. Yeah. Okay. Let's come back to Matthew's album.
Yeah. So Matthew's album was like, let's make a statement album. He had done a handful of 12 inches. I thought his music was at a level now that it could be. Because dance music albums often are pretty crap, right? Like, they're either trying to glom onto the success of a single and trying to pad it around with a couple intros and outros. And they tend to get a little conceptual, maybe.
Yeah. It's usually some sci-fi theme or a soundtrack for an imaginary film, one of those.
100%. And so I always liked the idea of Matthew as like a face in a good way. Like he's a person as opposed to like the classic Detroit image of like underground resistance and like,
right.
No, I was like, wait, what if we invert that? And Matthew sings live and Matthew like, and not as an attempt to like storm the charts. That was never the idea. It seemed more subversive to me to do that than to do another faceless dance record. It was like, what if you could have a person that was like a full functioning singer, but like actually a good producer? At the time, it seemed kind of controversial. Like his pictures on the back of the record, all of his early records, he's on it. It's like a Dylan thing. The idea of Matthew Dear is like a shape shifting concept. It was weird. That was all right. That was the idea. So that album is, you know, hundreds of songs whittled down into what I think is hopefully still a good flow and still like very dance heavy and club friendly, but also like shows his range. So yeah, I look at that as like one of our first best statements of what we were trying to do.
And that seemed, you feel, quite unusual at the time to have that face at the front and to be making a record that was so eclectic, maybe?
I think so. I think Micro House was the sort of genre that it got lumped into. I mean, Herbert obviously is like the don of that moment. Acufin, this sort of chopping samples and voices and kind of making that, I don't know, like pastiche. But Matt's were more like song structure. So it's like, it's not watering down techno, but it's like adding another like dimension. And I got, you know, the New York Times and Rolling Stone, and you know, a lot of people really picked up on it and understood what we were doing. But it predicted where Matt was going to go, which was like further into the avant-pop world.
So let's go back to Tad briefly. So Tad has all of these projects going on. So there's James T. Cotton, which is house and techno, Dabri, which is hip hop, Charles Mania, which is EBM. Although, was he releasing as Charles Mania right at the beginning even? Was that early on or was...
Yeah, at the time it was like his like EBM, like more dance floor. He'd Ghostly Five and Ghostly Nine. Because the joke is that Tad's like half of the first 10 records and different names.
So it looked like you had dozens of artists and actually quite a lot of them were Tad. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Let's talk about him working with J Dilla, because I guess Dilla at that point in the first few years of the decade of the century must have been a real local hero in Detroit, but perhaps wasn't exactly fully known or understood outside of Detroit. They ended up working together. And so I guess you were involved in that in some way. Tell me a bit about what happened there.
So yeah, J Dilla, he sort of popped up in different places. So he produced for The Far Side, produced for Tribe, obviously Slum Village, we were obsessed with. But he was at the record store on the weekends. You'd run into him, you'd see him. He wasn't, obviously he's become a deity, a legend. But at the time, he was just this like another genius dude from Detroit,
right.
You know? And so since the Tad's first record is very much indebted to Dilla's sound, our friend Riley Brennan, who was interviewing Dilla for a car magazine because he was a car reporter, and Dilla had his sick Benz. And I think on the tape of it, he asked Dilla, he's like, have you heard this guy Dabri? And you can hear him think. And he's like, oh, is it that like the white record with like the shapes on it? And Riley's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's like, oh yeah, I got that at record time. That's so dope. I love that. And he linked us. And so Tad and I drove to Dilla's and brought a beat tape that Tad had made, and Fat Cat, who's an amazing MC, who's on a lot of Tad's projects, and Dilla's projects, obviously, was there. And we were playing the B-tape in Dilla's studio in his basement. And they hit on the Game Over beat, and they both were, like, lit up. Like, all right, this is it. So Tad, he's like, we'll get it to you in, like, a week or whatever. So Tad and I go home. And then, yeah, a week later, we get a CDR in the mail, and it's Game Over, and it's a ridiculous song. And that also allowed Tad, who wanted to expand his sound, not just instrumental, but also include MCs, because that was where he wanted to go. So 2-3 came out, I think, in 2005, and Game Over, which came out a little bit before that, because we were still working on the album. It took a lot of time. It's like 20 tracks. That was one of our most big statement records at the time. It had Dilla, it had Doom, it had all these MCs we loved, 20 tracks. WK Interact, who we love as an artist, did the cover art. It's just another complete thought. You know, it wasn't very well reviewed. The story of the early Ghostly stuff is like, people liking what the artist did and then not liking that they evolved. Yeah, the Dabri project to me is one of the most important projects on Ghostly. And obviously being a hip hop fan and revering these artists, it feels like one of the truest to the vision. And Tad stewarded that, obviously.
So I watched your TED Talk, which is online.
Whoa.
So that was, it was about 10 years ago, I think. And one of the things that you talk about briefly in the TED Talk, which was, it was actually held at the University of Michigan. So I guess they invited you back as like a successful grad, right?
I think so. Yeah.
You talk a bit about experiencing a kind of a dip around 2006, the dip, mm-hmm. and the way that you kind of strategized yourself out there. And I guess that's interesting partly because I think plenty of labels maybe make it to the 5-year mark and then peter out for whatever reason. And it might be because the moment's gone and the scene that they're connected to isn't really a thing anymore, or more likely they just fell out with all their artists. But I guess you got to this some kind of point and strategized your way out of it in some way. So tell me about what the dip was for Ghostly.
Yeah, I kind of look at that era. The dip to me was ripped off. I mean, no, you know, acknowledging the ripoff of a Seth Godin idea, and I was trying to, you know, get into more. I guess it's like pop business psychology, just kind of finding analogs to look at, because the record business didn't really have a lot of role models. So I was trying to sort of find something to adhere to that felt sensible. And so I think I was getting more into that. A lot of it's crap, but you know, I still like Godin. I think he has good ideas. And that book spoke to me because it's about, you know, and this was all like fresh buzzwords at the time, like the 10,000 hours thing, where you're like, to get good at anything, it's like you get good fast because you go from nothing to you know, 20% good, and you feel like you're doing great. And then reality is you start to hit the hurdle of everyone can get to that point. And then it's like, how do you actually get through the next point? It's like, it's not a linear graph. It's a dip, and then you're back up past the waterline. Mm. So I think I look at that as our dip period, where we were kind of, again, technology stuff, money, you know, the sale of records was going down. Vinyl was dying a little bit. I just felt this sort of the steam had come out of the room. The exciting years, the growth years had ended. So I don't know how we consciously strategized out of it. I looked at it as sort of a willingness to eat shit for a little bit. It also is understanding that all, you know, back to the art history thing, any art movement is not a linear growth forever. It goes like this. So if you accept that, I mean, corporations aren't allowed to do that because shareholders need, you know, consistent value. Right. And obviously we've seen the downside of that play out. So I was like, what if you allow the company to decline, but use that energy and momentum to like reassert?
You talk a little bit in that talk as well about curation, the curation era, which again, I'm sure that when you gave that talk, that might have been a more buzzy word in a sense. And now it feels like curation is like, oh God, everything's curated now. But I wonder how you feel that that's developed a bit, because is it getting harder to get your music to the right people, to the people who you think would want to hear it? Or have you worked out ways to make that happen for you more easily with new technology?
Yeah, it's a good call. I mean, yeah, it was definitely a buzzword, but I also felt it definitely was exciting because it felt like the label doesn't have to be judged solely on whatever last month's release was. It was like the ideology of like the art museum. You don't know what's going to be at the Tate in 6 months, but you should be able to trust that we're going to hold a standard or at least be interesting. So that gave me a lot of excitement. Also, that's the beginning of the collaborations and the products and kind of thinking of Ghostly as a platform for physical objects as well. Not as a revenue strategy. I think people get it wrong. They're like, oh, it's cool you have the merch so that you can make money when records don't. It's like, it doesn't really work that way. It's really more another distillation of an idea in a time like we talked about. And so being able to do a flash drive with Moss or sunglasses with Warby, it's like another thing to talk about, another cool project. So I think the timing, the multimedia aspect of Ghostly begins around there.
One thing that's often a big part of the story for independent labels, as you've kind of mentioned with Creation and 4AD, is the finances of it. And Ghostly was founded with, you got some investment from your dad, right? And I was wondering, you know, kind of like in the interest of transparency, how do you think Ghostly would have worked if you hadn't had an initial kind of investment? Because nowadays it's a little bit different because you can basically just start a label online and you don't really need to have much investment at all to get started. But when you started, you did, and you've weathered quite a lot of changes in the industry anyway. I mean, how important was it for you to have actually had that boost at the beginning.
But yeah, I think now you're right. I mean, yes, we could start a label today. You and I could throw it up on Bandcamp, and that's great. I think that's great. That's the democratization at work. And there's downsides to that too, because there's just more artists and more labels and harder to make a name. But at the same time, it's great because any artist can have a label and should have a label. But at the time to make a thing, I don't know. I probably would have had to wait longer. I worked at a record store in college and a clothing store in high school and had a little bit of, and then DJ money, but I wouldn't have been able to get the first record out as quickly. I probably would have had to work for another year or two to save up the money to do it right. So yeah, there's no question that, especially in the physical era, it wouldn't have been the same.
And after that, was it just purely you making decisions as they came up, or did you, are you a kind of spontaneous person or a 5-year plan kind of person?
I think a little bit of both, because I look at some choices we've made and I'm like, that was really smart in retrospect. And some things I'm like, that was really stupid. So it's, I think at the time, and I think that's why I was like getting more into like business theory, was just because I wanted to feel like I didn't go to business school. So I wanted to feel like I was actually like had some skills. I'm not really an accountant type, but I think I believe in like longevity and I believe in like investment and projects that make sense. And obviously with streaming and whatnot, it's proven, it's, and we also licensing, we were early into sort of trying to figure out how to get our music into commercials and TV shows. And that was really where our artists made their money at the beginning. Matt and Tad and their first real like chance to like invest or have a life was out of those decisions. So was I a great operator? Maybe not, but we did pick some of the right lanes to put our time into.
I wanted to ask a little bit about, so Telephone Tel Aviv joined the label. What happened in the lead up to that? Because you ended up reissuing their first album and then releasing Josh's album under the Telephone Tel Aviv name last year.
Yeah, Josh is like the person you fancy for years in school and don't get to ever date until you're an adult. So I met Josh probably around 2000, 2001. We were in Ann Arbor, Michigan. They were in Chicago, Telephone and the Hefty Records crew. And we kind of had a love affair of young labels. And we would visit them there. And we invited Telephone, Josh and Charlie to play in Ann Arbor, I think in 2000. So yeah, I was just a fan. And then we actually worked on Ghostly Swim together, the Ghostly Swim compilation. It was 20 different songs from different artists. So it had all sorts of sonic disparity, and I was like, we need to like glue this together somehow. So I took it to Josh's studio in Chicago, and he with me over his shoulder mixed some and mastered it, and kind of, and he put it to tape even, so it kind of like really stuck together. So I just like working with Josh. He has a really great ear, and that was right at the eve of Telephone's album Immolate Yourself. He had just finished it, so we were listening to that. And shortly after the album came out, Charlie Cooper, half of Telephone at the time, passed away. So Charlie was a dear friend, and another just kind of like shocking moment. And so we obviously, you know, tried to support Josh as a friend through the years and helped with like licensing stuff, publishing stuff. And then eventually it seemed likely that he was going to make more music. We kind of gave him a kick in the butt, and he finished his album, Dreams Are Not Enough.
How did you feel about what he came up with on Dreams Are Not Enough? I mean, I know it got a lot of acclaim, but what was your kind of relationship to it? Because having been a fan and then having it on your label, I don't know, maybe it's, is it easy to be the kind of A&R function in that sense when you're, you know, you've been a fan rather than a kind of nurturer?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, someone like Josh, who's so accomplished and has toured with giant bands and whatnot, I don't feel like my job is to tell him like what I think of the songs. It's more like encouraging him to release it to the world, you know?
Are you generally quite hands-off from an A&R perspective? Do you have much input into like track selection and ordering and things like that?
Depends on the artist. Some artists kind of deliver a sort of finished object and maybe we'll give notes on track listing. Sometimes artists need help with pairing up with other artists, so we do that sometimes. It totally depends.
A kind of nerdy question, but I also saw that when you reissued Fahrenheit Fair Enough, it was actually remastered as well. Is that right?
Yes.
I was curious about why you would remaster something that was made in 2001. what kind of benefits there are in that. I'm just curious about, see, to me, I understand why a record from the 70s or 80s might get remastered, but it's quite interesting to think that in 20 years, there is something that can be done with something that was digital in the first place.
That's a really good question.
This may be, I mean, this may be beyond my understanding anyway.
I think in some ways, actually, a record from 2001 could have easily have been, like the sort of loudness wars of the 2000s people talk about, the idea that mastering got louder and louder. So I think actually 2001, things were really shrill from what I remember. I think the way that people probably bounced files, I'm not a wizard with this stuff, but we remastered Dad Raised 1-3. We had Daddy Kev, who does a lot of the, you know, brain feeder sound, remaster it, because Tad did it before in 2001, and it sounded good, but it sounded like 2001. And whereas, like, I think Kev was able to give it a little more roundedness and, like, fullness without changing the character of the sound. So, yeah, I think every era has its sort of limitations or expectations, where I think sort of tinnier stuff sounded cooler then. but we're at a place now, maybe we have better headphones, we have better playback, there's more expectation. So I like the idea that things constantly can be reassessed.
Yeah, for sure. So I have these quick fire questions to jazz it up.
Sure.
If Ghostly was an animal, what animal would it be?
I'd probably say a turtle. maybe because we just put a t-shirt out that had a turtle on it. It made me smile. That's what comes to mind. Yeah.
If Ghostly was a menu item, what would it be?
I think like elote, sort of like corn with some cheese and tasty, nourishing. That's all I got.
Nourishing though. That's good. It's like, it's wholesome. It's good for you. Okay. If Ghostly was a season, which of the seasons?
I've always thought of Ghostly as like a autumnal label.
I agree.
Change in the
air. I totally agree.
Yeah. Okay, good. we got a match.
Yeah, it's like if you don't choose fall autumnal, then I would be confused.
Yeah, no, melancholy, but joy, beauty and the sadness, sadness and the beauty.
Would you rather be in the city or the country?
I guess the city. I like stimulation, even if it's not mine, it's there. It's like something to feed off of.
What was the last book that you read?
Last book I read was, I've been doing digital books, so my memory is less visual.
I find it's harder to remember books that I've read as an ebook. They kind of don't sit in my mind in the same way.
Same with MP3s and vinyl and stuff. True. And streaming. I feel like it's just, you don't have that tactile. I just read a book about the art market called Boom that was cool because it kind of filled in a lot of art historical gaps that I didn't have about the gallery culture and how it arose. So it's kind of a trashy title, but the subject was actually really, really good.
Okay, finally, what was the last film that you saw?
I've been watching a lot of the Hugh Grant movies with my wife, and those have been pretty good. like soft brain kind of fun. So yeah, I've actually been liking those a lot.
That's nice. Quarantine brain, nostalgic, lovely.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, I wanted to talk to you a bit about the brand, I guess, or the various things that Ghostly does that are around the music. And one of the things that you launched quite a long time ago that I think was very prescient in a lot of ways was Drip, which I guess in retrospect maybe didn't work out, but also, I think, really laid the blueprint for a lot of what people are still trying to do with music in terms of getting people access to the music they like in a way that copes with the fact that the record stores are shut and the industry has changed so much. So tell me a little bit about about what Drip was and why you came up with it and what happened with it.
Yeah, so Drip started... It kind of, the sort of seeds of it are, we had an iPhone app called Discovery, and it was a color wheel mood-based. We tagged our catalog by hand, by mood, color, you know, it's obviously very subjective, and you could put your finger over purple, which meant whatever, and then faster, slower, more electronic or less electronic,
and it would like create a little playlist. And that was really fun. And I think it got us kind of thinking like, oh, maybe we could do more stuff in technology. Maybe like we're allowed to play in that sandbox. So my colleague, Miguel Sanquis, who's now at SoundCloud in Berlin, he was working at Ghostly, and we were like, what if we do like a subscription service? Because people were like, why can't I just buy everything? Just send it to me, like a subscription. So we made Ghostly Music Service, just really hack. And there was no like subscription platforms at the time that worked. So we made it for ourselves, and we were like, we're paying a good amount of, you know, $10 or $15 a month for MP3s. We're like, okay, this is something. So like, what if we open this up as its own brand? Obviously Drip being the action of getting stuff sent to you. Somewhere between fan club, high quality files, artist access, artist patronage. And I think the long-term vision was I wanted to get to a place where, you know, PETA had a Drip and Record Store had a Drip, that you could just, everything, my interests were like what I subscribed to, and I could see what you subscribe to, and we could be like, oh, you also do this, I'll check that out, and sort of kind of like an affinity group. So instead of just social media where it's like a passive, like what you subscribe to becomes kind of your like coat of arms. And obviously music's a great place to start. So we had probably 50 or so labels and artists, Stone's Throw, Mad Decent, and Fool's Gold, and even like jam bands and stuff. It was cool. It was getting to a good place. I think we didn't quite nail the execution as far as like the perfect amount of stuff to get for the money. It wasn't mobile. So I think there's a lot of stuff that we could have done better, but everyone made money. No one, we didn't make money, but all the artists who signed up made money. So I feel like it wasn't a failure. I think right now actually Drip would be really well received.
I think the idea of Drip would serve the function of something like a fan club, which again is like not something that people do anymore. And although people can interact with their fans very easily now, it's maybe harder for the fans to even find each other. It's one thing for a fan to be able to send a message or a tweet to the artist that they like, but it's not so easy for them to identify each other and hang out together, which in many ways historically is what music is about, the kind of tribalism, right, of being a fan and stuff. Right. But then on the other hand, what I found really interesting was that you'd come up with a mood-based way to listen, which is exactly what Spotify does now. It was interesting that you'd thought of that first.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of other variants on that. But yeah, I think we try to think about what we would want. So it's like, yeah, like Pandora was cool at the time because it was like, oh, I like Bob Dylan. But that's like the wrong way up the funnel. And it was like, how do you feel, or how do you want to feel, is actually how you approach music. When you're going through your records, you're not like, I want to go find that blank album. You're like, I want a record that will chill me out. And then that whittles your collection down to this. Yeah, I think Spotify's done a great job with that. I think Bandcamp's done a great job of making the fan club aspect of buying music feel palpable and personal, but there's still a missing link. So maybe one day we'll get the itch and figure it out. But there's also a lot of really cool startups that are trying to solve this too. So I hope someone does.
How often does Ghostly get tapped up for syncs with TV or games or films? Because it seems like that could be quite a large amount of your remit at this point.
Yeah, it's very hard to predict. Even everyone's like, oh, that would sync well, or that would sound good in the movie. But it's oftentimes right. The stuff that you wouldn't expect that gets synced, things that no one would have pegged. We do searches every day. We have a full-time person who is pretty much responsible for just making sure that we answer all those emails and try to get music.
Oh, wow.
It's been responsible for some of our artists' best, you know, performances and royalty statements for sure, and has helped artists build studios and support families and things, which makes me feel good. But it's just hard. You can't market it. It just happens, or it doesn't.
Could you give me some examples of those as well? Because I think you ended up doing or kind of arranging a Minecraft soundtrack. Is that right? And some other kind of game stuff?
The Minecraft one is more of us just sort of productizing an existing thing. So We love the C418 score is like this kind of Satie piano thing. It just, you don't think of it as that because the image is like blocks and shapes, but it's actually this really elegant score. And so one of our friends in Ann Arbor linked us up with Daniel C418, and we just were like, hey, can we press this on vinyl? It had been out, you know, so that's just more of us trying to create a artifact out of an existing, and like even, you know, I think Mojo was like, less computer game music, more instant ambient classic. So it's cool that, like, again, like kind of the high-low thing, it's like taking it out of context.
Oh, so that came the other direction. So that existed for Minecraft and then you pressed it for vinyl?
Yeah, we had nothing to do with the production or making of it. We just helped disseminate it further.
Also, maybe what are some of the bigger TV or film syncs that have popped up? Be interesting to know who's done really well out of it and who's been able to build a studio.
Early days, we had a Motorola Razr flip phone commercial, which was Dabry's first album. That was that was our first real like proper sync and a cool ad that actually fit the music and vice versa. Matthew Deer had a couple big commercials. Mary Lattimore is in the trailer for Little Women recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is really
that's
cool.
That's really nice. I mean,
it's really fun. I think it's nice when the artist makes the music for themselves and their fans, but it also finds a second life. You know, it's not a compromise. Obviously, the artist has 100% sign off on if they want to do the license or not. We don't force it.
Do you think you were one of the first labels, or maybe the first label, to sell music on a USB stick?
Maybe one of, yeah. Again, there's so many like cool net labels and things. I think the USB thing isn't that novel. I think the idea was just making art out of something or making an object out of something that was, because that was a time of like, I remember every hotel had a CD, like Hotel Costs and Cafe Del Mar. And like that was the era of like the CD mixed as the like brand ambassadorship.
Yeah.
So this store Moss in New York that my friend Brian, who later worked at Ghostly and helped us start the store, he's like, we play your music in the store all the time. Do you want to do a CD for us? And I'm like, yeah, we could do that. And then I was like, well, what if we made an object that you sold at the store that was a design object? The execution was okay. It probably wasn't the most, it was like 128 megs, which sounds hilarious now considering we had to limit the number of songs like to 12 because that was all it would fit. And we just like, you know, it was cool. It was a fun way to break the mold of what that could be. So.
And Moss is a kind of interesting store, right? It's closed down now, I think. Is that right?
It's closed.
But it's like a boutique design store in a sense, right? It's about kind of beautiful objects, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it kind of dovetailed with like the boom of like Wallpaper magazine and like 2000s. It had an aura and had a vibe, and our music sounded cool in the space. So I was honored that we could do something with them.
And so at what point did you get the idea to have a Ghostly store? Was that around the same kind of time?
There's always been a Ghostly store. Like there's been a web shop. And like at the beginning, I had my friend who had made these cool little vases, had them on the site. I don't think we ever sold any. And we had apparel and like more merch type stuff. But we sort of torqued it up around late 2000s. Brian joined the team. Brian he was a buyer at Cooper Hewitt Museum. So he had a lot of contacts trying to build out like the aesthetic of Ghostly through third party stuff too. So we were selling non-Ghostly design goods, you know, stationery and like Japanese pens and an expanded lifestyle. It was never really like a huge profit initiative, but it was a fun way to like show our interests beyond music.
And how's that changed over time then? Because it seems to me like it's more of a destination or a kind of headquarters in some sense. Is it, do you consider the store to be like the front of the operation in a way?
I think we kind of smashed the two together because in the past it was like ghostly.com and the Ghostly store, and they kind of had their own aesthetic. And the idea of the new site was to push it all back together. So it's really just our living archive. And there's actually like remnants of Ghostly Discovery are in it because you can search by mood in the function. So it's like a little nod to the past, but it's meant to be just a living archive of everything we've done. And that includes products too. So I don't think of it as the store anymore as far as a separate thing. I think of it as just retail as a function of what we do. And we try to make more original stuff or original collaborations in recent years with like Warby Parker and Vans and Stutterheim and stuff that we're actually involved in the making of, not just reselling.
But there is still a bricks and mortar storefront, isn't there?
No. Oh. We've had pop-ups.
Oh.
We did one with Odin. We did one with Notra in Chicago last year. Some of the dream board, but it keeps sliding to the bottom of the board for some reason.
Okay, so in that case, I think I was reading about, it was quite an old New York Times profile where I guess it must have been more of a pop-up, maybe in Greenpoint?
I think a lot of people assume it's a store because we call it a store, and also there's pictures of a store. So
I kind of liked it was a store. Yeah, I had it.
That makes me happy.
In my mind.
Yeah, that's a good sign. And I think if we had a store, it would be really exciting. It's something I definitely want to do in my life, whatever it is physical space. But right now, especially, it seems like a big undertaking.
Yeah, for sure. There was something quite funny about that New York Times write-up as well. Like, it was written in that very arch New York Times kind of way. At one point, they called it Goop for the Pitchfork set, which I'm keen to know how you reacted to being labeled like the Gwyneth Paltrow of indie electronic. But
it's a nice like backhanded compliment, but I thought the piece was really nice, so I can't complain. It's a good line. I like it. I don't know if it's totally accurate. I don't think people look to us to be we're not a overarching brand for a certain crowd. I think it's people say like lifestyle brand, and I think that at first I kind of reacted negatively to that, but now I think all my favorite brands have been lifestyle brands. I think Nike is a lifestyle brand. I think Apple in its heyday was a lifestyle brand. I think Patagonia is probably the best lifestyle brand of all time. Ghostly was supposed to be sort of a faux corporate brand at the beginning. Even the name is kind of a piss take, like Ghostly International.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be like a little like obviously sort of like funny. It's not a big company, but I like the aesthetics of branding and I like the corporata. Even like I have a piece of factory letterhead in my room and it's so sterile and boring. And I'm like, but it's so perfect. I think.
So I want to ask you about the latest album that's come out, the new Caitlin Aurelia Smith album called The Mosaic of Transformation. Now, this one and also the Mary Latimore album that you flagged up when we spoke before as well, which she's a harpist, an instrumental harpist. And Caitlin Aurelia Smith is a synthesist, I guess you'd say. These two records kind of interest me in the ghostly pantheon because they tap into a different kind of mellow, contemplative home listening. Ghostly have released a lot of records that I think are good for that kind of mood. But these are different. And maybe especially with Caitlin's, there's this kind of West Coast spirituality, even, dare I say, kind of wooiness, which maybe is kind of at odds with the Midwestern grit, authenticity, kind of futurism. And that led me to wonder how you relate to that music now and if you've kind of softened into that type of music in any sense, how it reflects your own changes as well as the label.
I guess I think of hopefully all the artists we've worked with, the thesis is that their voice, their inner voice, is bigger than whatever tool they use. So at the time, electronic music when we started was kind of considered to be like not music by a lot of people, or like rock circles, it was like too easy or too sterile. So the idea was like, let's find these artists who have such a voice that it supersedes the tools of the time. So the work of Tad or Matt to me felt like bigger than the platform in a good way. And I think of Mary and Caitlin as artists who supersede their tools. They master their tool and then they become a bigger, to use the art historical jargon, transubstantiate the whole thing. And so I like those voices. I think those are the artists that you remember. Mary can't be reduced. She can be, and maybe she's fine with it, but to me, she can't be reduced as a harpist, which is a function. She's a musician who uses this tool masterfully with pedals and synths sometimes, and she collaborates a lot. Caitlin, obviously, with the Buchla and voice, creates this like whole spectrum. So I think the sonics, maybe with age, just the music feels more in line with what I personally listen to. But also I think it's a revolution in not only home recording, but also maybe more of a gender gap. I like the idea that the best musicians in the world right now are women, or at least the most popular. Maybe they always have been, but the exposure and the velocity of innovation is being driven by non-men, which is, I think, a good thing.
Yeah, and I think it's obvious looking at, I mean, this does not only apply to Ghostly, but the label rosters of electronic labels around the year 2000, there were really virtually no women at all, really, you know, a tiny handful. And now that's completely flipped. And it's interesting with Caitlin as well, because she's not only an electronic musician, but her instrument is this kind of notoriously complicated Buchla synthesizer, right? Which is not something that many people even use. And again, same with harp. It's not a synth, but I mean, it must be complicated. I assume it's incredibly technically difficult. So it kind of upends, you know, a stereotype, I guess. So thinking back on a broader scale, if we can condense the Ghostly timeline in some way, obviously the music industry, it changes a lot all the time anyway, but in this particular 20-21 years that you've run a label, there have been so many changes. And I was curious about how you see your own predictions. Have you made many predictions over the years that have turned out to be right or wrong and that have affected the label?
I mean, it's always, everything's a prediction, right? Because you're signing an artist and
right. You're
hoping that they succeed. Yeah, I don't know. In some ways, I think maybe it's just like the age I am, like the ego death kind of hit. So I don't have as much. I care less about being right and more about like, did we do a good job? I think we made good predictions about where the industry would go, maybe at a macro level with Discovery or Drip or, but it doesn't really matter because it matters and it feels good, but it's not, those aren't the bedrock of our brand. I mean, those are just thought experiments. But that's also personal fulfillment too. For me, it feels good to be up against something and not just sort of playing into the moment. It's like there should be some tension.
I think you've always been willing and keen to engage with technological changes, to try new things, and to potentially lead the way. At the moment, though, we're also seeing this real consolidation of power in not just major labels, the kind of age-old baddie of the system, but with tech companies as well, because effectively Apple and Google and Spotify have a lot of power, especially as far as a small independent label or artist is concerned. And I wonder what you think the role of an independent label can be in the future, given that you have to work with these big companies, tech companies, to even get the music out there, in a sense. I mean, what is the point of even having an independent record label now, I guess?
Yeah, I think the dream, the internet dream, maybe is gone. Like the
right.
Wild West. I don't want to demonize any of these companies because I don't know if that's really the way forward. I also don't put my faith in any big tech company as a salvation either. They're public companies that have shareholder needs, and that's the North Star. So I think independent labels are always going to be a thing, even if it's just an artist releasing their own music, because I always love independent record labels now and then as relatively democratic. A good song is a good song. It's irrefutable. If you make it available and people like it, it's good. Whereas fine art, it's like, where'd you go to school? What gallery are you represented by? Then I'll talk to you. Film obviously has a lot of distribution disparity and production value question marks. And maybe that's been crushed, but I still feel like there's a hierarchy there. Literature, I don't know enough about as far as fiction, but I'm guessing is still publisher driven. And obviously Amazon and, you know, it's a pipeline. But yeah, music is still free. I mean, if a good song can come out of nowhere and be as good or better than anything on the charts, the promise of the independent labels maybe more important than ever, just the function and semantics have changed, you know?
If you were 20 years old right now, would you want to start a label?
Yeah. And I think it would look similar to what we're doing now. It probably, you know, would be more savvy. It probably would be utilizing even newer tools or be focused on the next gen app. But yeah, I think the idea of a culture hub focused on music is like a forever principle.
Very nice. Well, in that case, I'm going to say thank you for joining me on Relevant Parties, Sam.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Relevant Parties from Carhartt Work in Progress. If you want to dive into more music from the labels in this series, check out the Relevant Parties playlist on Spotify. You can find the link in the show notes. And remember, you can subscribe to Relevant Parties so that you never miss an episode. It's available wherever good podcasts are found. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to leave a rating and a comment on Apple Podcasts. We'd really love to know what you think. So thanks for listening, and join me next time for more stories behind the world's best record labels.